What do people say? Oh, well, no one will want to work in a company that goes to homes of low-income people. Okay, they're wrong. Oh, those people don't want healthcare. You know, they won't trust you. You can't get into the home. They're wrong. You can't make money in Medicaid. They're wrong. There's a reason why Nest is the only company in the U.S. doing primary care for kids at home.
Welcome to The Other 80. I'm Claudia Williams. I want you to imagine for a second being a single parent of six kids. You have a baby at home, you have meals to cook, homework to help with, a house to clean, a job to go to, and on top of that, you don't even have a car. You're struggling just to hold it all together, so how are you going to get yourself or your kids to the doctor when they need it? It seems almost impossible. Dr. Rebecca Gee is working on one possible solution. She wants to bring American families a service many Europeans already have, improved access to primary care through home visits. Her company, Nest, is working to deliver better care at a reduced cost by bringing healthcare to the patient instead of the other way around. So please welcome Dr. Rebecca Gee to The Other 80. I don't know if we've ever met. I feel like we've been in probably several common spaces, but it's just so nice to meet you. I just love the combination of entrepreneurship, Medicaid, and policymaking. So we'll dive more into that. I just want to start by asking, what's important to know about you?
I am a parent of five children, two sets of twins, born in Utah. I'm the great-great-granddaughter of a Mormon prophet. So I think it's interesting as I think about Nest, this notion of, or entrepreneurship, being a daughter of pioneers. Thinking about the family, certainly that was something that I grew up with, really strong sense of what does family mean. Live in New Orleans, where I have really enjoyed being a public health leader, but also had the opportunity to train in the Northeast. And so I've had and work globally. So I've had this kind of global perspective on maternal and child health. And I've led, you know, the health department in Louisiana. I led our Medicaid expansion, and prior to that, led birth outcomes improvements here. I've spent the vast majority of my career either taking care of patients. I'm a physician and OBGYN. I'm taking care of patients who are women, advocating for women and children as a researcher through the work and inquiries that I've done, and then as a policymaker and now entrepreneur.
I think you're my first guest whose story was featured on This American Life. And I wanted to start by asking you about your mom and the letters she wrote you before she died and how that's guided you or how you've diverged from that.
I'm the daughter of a university president, grew up kind of moving around the U.S. I was very, very close to my mother, and my mother was a professional ethicist and very focused on how do we find ethical expression through our work. She was diagnosed with a recurrent breast cancer when I was 15 and unfortunately died in home hospice right after my 16th birthday. But while she was dying, spent her days writing letters to me that I opened then each year for my birthday. My dad would send them in a FedEx envelope. He never read these letters, but they were really referent to her experiences at that age, what her dreams and hopes were for me. And I think what has sustained me, first of all, is I do believe that she is in me, right? That we are all interconnected, but certainly her hopes for me in terms of my ethical expression of my work, that is what I do, right? Nest is, it is very core about human dignity and human capacity building. And I think being a physician came from her. That was not something I aspired to. I was kind of a geeky astronaut wannabe. And I think when she got sick, I decided I wanted to solve problems on Earth and really work to be a caregiver for, especially for women. The last part, which This American Life covered, is that I grew up LDS, and her fervent desire for me was that I would continue in that faith. And you know, most of the time when you have arguments with your parents and you're a young person, you can argue physically with them. And yet I was kind of sat with these letters where she was gone and I knew I was disappointing her. And so coming off as I decided to leave the church and I went to Columbia College in New York, and she in many ways, I think, facilitated my leaving the church because she had introduced me to like existentialist philosophers and traveled the world with, you know, with me. And so I gone to art museums. So I do think she kind of hastened the parting, but yeah, so I dealt with that, but it was a great process. And again, I think as a mother now, I think a lot about her, what she would do, and hopefully she would love this nest concept. I think it very much, I'm adopted also. I didn't mention that, but I think this notion of every child has infinite potential, certainly comes from me. I now know who my birth parents were and know that none of them went to college. They had drug addiction. My life would have been very, very different. And here I have, you know, 4 Ivy League degrees. I've had this amazing life, and much of it is due to my circumstances, not my doing. And so that's partly where Nest comes from, right? This notion that why can't every child thrive? Mm. If only given the right opportunities, every child can thrive.
So you came out of being the Secretary of Health in Louisiana and from this amazing personal history of focusing on birth outcomes and children and thriving and Medicaid. It wasn't an obvious transition to start a company. No. I mean, maybe there isn't ever an obvious transition to do that. What was drawing you or pulling you into that path?
Well, I've always loved, Claudia, disruptive innovation, right? So when I was a government official, both when I was CMO for Medicaid or CMO for Title V or secretary, I was a rabble-rouser, right? So I was looking whether it was tackling the high price of the hepatitis C drugs and creating a subscription model, or creating the South's first office of health equity and a health department, or creating a family planning waiver during the Republican Jindal administration and getting the support from Republicans because it was part of a birth outcomes initiative, or suing Walmart over Plan B. That was my first foray into advocacy as a resident, was suing Walmart and winning. And helped get them to change their national policy on Plan B and their pharmacies across the country. So as I looked at opportunities, it came from what was not there. I started to look at other startups and started to get interested in what was happening in innovation in American healthcare. And I looked at them all, and either they were focused on just maternity. And you know, even though I'm an OB, I know that pregnancy is too late, right? If we're focusing on helping moms who are already pregnant, because, by the way, I'd spent 10 years doing this, right, in leading the health department and birth outcomes in the highest maternal mortality state in the U.S., we did everything. We threw the kitchen sink at it, and yet we're not able to dramatically reduce it. And so what I came from after that was that pregnancy is too late. If you're only focused on women when they're pregnant and you don't focus on their well-being, their economic advancement, their health in between pregnancies, their access to contraception, their mental health, and it's just not going to work. And it hasn't worked, right? Because despite all of these efforts nationally to improve maternal health, focusing on pregnancy, we're not doing better than we were 10 years ago. In fact, we're doing worse. So I think that I didn't see the solution. I thought I'd go join a board of one of these companies that was doing something good.
Tell them what to do.
Well, heck, I ended up meeting a venture capitalist, and I had ideas, about 20 ideas that I shared with him about if we were going to make government work better or think about the healthcare system. This is what I'd like to see. And he said, well, how about I fund you to do Nest? The idea is that there are about 50% of children in America and about an equal number of mothers postpartum who do not get care. And if we are just assuming that they're going to come into our clinic, our health center, our whatever, hospitals, we're wrong. So we've got to think about ways to engage with them at home, engage with the entire family. And so I think that the idea is compelling. I think obviously the work is how do you actually make it scale as a business? And that's where I've spent the last 2 years of learning, is how do we actually get this to work? And it's been a really, I'll say I've learned more as an entrepreneur. Even I ran a health department, $60 billion I oversaw, 8,000 employees, 2,000 hospital beds. And yet I've learned more about leadership from being a startup CEO, because there's nothing like founding something yourself and building it from the ground up, whether it's the culture, how do you pay people equitably? What are you doing? What is your mission? How do you structure it? How do you structure equity at your company? Do you provide it to all employees or just the C-suite? All of those things. And then when HR issues happen, you know, when I was at the health department, I could look to the right and left and say, hey guys, you deal with it. You know, at Nest, I'm dealing with it. So I'd say what's interesting about this journey is I've learned more, Claudia, about leadership than I ever have. And it really has been a wonderful journey.
Let's bring this model alive for the listener. I love the idea of whole person at home care. Imagine a mom, working mom, super busy, finding the time to take your kids who might be at different doctors and yourself who's at a different doctor for preventive screenings or preventive checkups just seems impossible when you're trying to put dinner on the table and all of this. I'd just love to hear from that perspective you just shared of like starting from the ground up. How did you start to build that model? Because we're familiar with that model, I think, for people that are homebound maybe in Medicare Advantage or from a concierge standpoint for really wealthy people. But centering that parent with kids at home, busy working person is not something we're accustomed to. So how did you start to build that? What were the pieces you needed to put together?
Yeah, and Claudia, it's not just that, but the people we're taking care of, imagine being a mom of six with a new baby at home and you're a single mother and you have no car. So just walk me through how you're going to get yourself to the doctor. You know, so it really is a profound challenge. And the building of it happened in a variety of ways. It was through inputs from the walks I've taken in my career. A, you know, having run Title V, I knew about nurse family partnership. I had run a waiver in Louisiana to send social workers into homes. And so I knew the data on what home visiting does for moms and kids. It was just it's very apparent that it saves money and improves outcomes. I know as a mom, and having been through COVID, I think part of this was wanting to be an activist on behalf of women after COVID, is during COVID, we were asked to do so many things, you know, cook, clean the house, you know, teach the kids, become a teacher, do your job, hold it together, all of that. And then, and yet, you know, society doesn't really hold out helping hands, you know, versus my friends who live in Germany or the UK, they have home visiting, they have services, they have free daycare, they have paid family leave. These things don't exist for many of us in the U.S. So realizing that the need for this was even greater in the U.S. And then Nest was born in part by a conversation I had with Don Berwick. So Don, who founded IHI, I sit on the board of IHI. And I, after one of these primary care conversations where I felt really underwhelmed by what's out there, I went to Don and said, Don, just tell me, where's the best primary care in the world? And he said, well, you've got to go to Alaska. And so I did, and I went to this system called the Nuka Health System that was designed in part by and for Alaska Native peoples. And the whole concept is that health, and it's partly right based on some of the thinking of Native peoples about the relationship between the earth and our families, our community, to our health. We are not just living individually, being healthy by ourselves, right? So health happens in communities. And so this notion that health happens in a home setting, that we can deal with remote geographies by bringing healthcare to people. I thought, well, this is just as relevant in an urban geography where mom has no car as it is if I live in a remote Alaskan village. So the concept started to grow out of Nuka and then informed by nurse family partnership. So I really wanted to create a model that brought in that community health worker mentality, but used a medical person. So we're using in our model medical assistants who can take a blood pressure, do a blood draw, you know, do it, you know, participate in medical services. So all of that came to inform this Nest model that is comprehensive primary care at home and virtually for the entire household, really bringing those different pieces together. And then finally, I wanted to create a company that would be profitable and could scale and wasn't reliant on grant funds. So the idea was, how do we take these concepts that have been used in public health so effectively, but have Medicaid pay for it. Use that system that covers half of our children and half of our pregnant women to improve the lives of these families.
I, in my work at the Berkeley School of Public Health, work a lot with students at the School of Public Health who don't necessarily see themselves as entrepreneurs, but have an incredibly strong mission focus. And so part of, I think, what we're trying to help share through stories like yours is this knowledge, this experience from community health is so relevant for building companies. Now, yes, you need other expertise around raising funds and the financial models and all of that, but bringing that mission and that experience puts you in an amazing place to build an impactful company. It doesn't have to be somebody from the business school. I know that you faced, as many startups do, a lot of skepticism at the beginning. What was the basis of that skepticism and how have you countered that?
You know, what do people say? Oh, well, no one will want to work in a company that goes to homes of low-income people. Okay, they're wrong. Oh, those people don't want healthcare. You know, that was said to me multiple times. You know, they won't trust you. You can't get into the home. They're wrong. You can't make money in Medicaid. They're wrong. You can't save money on families or children. They were wrong. There's a reason why Nest is the only company in the U.S. that is doing primary care for kids at home. And it is because, A, it takes a family to be able to make the economics work. We don't just take care of a child at a time. It's also more effective, though, by the way. Like, we can't have thriving children if mom is depressed and mom is not healthy. You know, it's all interrelated. So it just makes sense as a model, but it makes sense financially. So we need more people who have the lived experience to come in and start things. And there are always going to be people who will help you. I mean, I have a CFO. I've learned a lot about P&L and finance. I feel like I've gotten a mini MBA, but I have a team. That's what your team is for, to help build around you and grow those areas where you may have deficits. So, you know, I really encourage it. I think the other piece, though, just to be honest, and this was something I did not anticipate, is that I had been Secretary of Health in Louisiana, where we had, you know, only 11% females in our legislature. So very much a man's world, lots of inappropriate comments and lots of talking to my 22-year-old intern instead of me because he's a man kind of experiences. And I did not expect Venture to be that way. I sometimes joke, I wish I was named Bob, because all of the data shows that we're two female founders. Both named Rebecca, which is kind of fun. But if you have a co-founder who's a man, or you're a man founder, you're much, much more likely to get capital. So of all of the founders, only 2% of them funded by venture are female. So I have noticed that I have to be more prepared, have a better story, have better outcomes, have to overcome more skepticism than my male colleagues who have gone out there and started things. It kind of feels like, you know, if you're in a gymnast and you're looking at the order of difficulty of the routine, it just feels like every routine is a difficult routine.
I'm glad that you had that grounding in being entrepreneurial and your advocacy and other things starting before, because you do have to learn that just because there was a no this time doesn't mean there's going to be a no next time and keep on going. You really focused on this point of scaling and how there have been a lot of great grant-funded efforts, but ultimately they didn't have a business model. They didn't have a scaling approach. So I want to take that scaling in two pieces. One, how do you scale the operations? How do you actually deliver the services? And then the second, how do you scale the financial model?
So currently we have about 10,000 people across South Louisiana that we care for. These are families. It could be a mom and her children. It could be multiple children. It could be a pregnant mom, or it could be sometimes there's a dad, mom, and kids. So it's really is those family units. And we're going in with nurse practitioners and medical assistants for the primary care well visits. And then our other services are virtual. So we're doing behavioral health, nutrition, specialty care amenable to virtual. We're doing 24/7 care management, doing, you know, ER diversion, all of that is in this model. And so the operations are complex. No one had ever been able to scale childhood vaccination through the Vaccination for Kids program at home. So figuring all of that out, what's the temperature? How do we do all this? And how do we identify, you know, families and schedule them? What is the periodicity of our visits? All of that. But I would say how we scale it is how you scale all of these other home-based solutions. First of all, I found a team. My entire senior team, except for me, came from for-profit companies that have scaled home-based care. So my co-founder scaled Landmark from 2 to 25 states. So from the very beginning, we have had incredible talent and people that know how to scale these businesses. So everything from the operations to how we set up our physician oversight structure to our quality program to our billing and coding, all of that was built with the eye for this will not just be in Louisiana, it will be a nationally impactful company. Our trademark, all of that, you know, so building that, you know, kind of setting that moat around you to say, what is it we're doing and how do I protect this intellectual property? And then in terms of the financial, right? So it's about growth in your business. So how do I grow contracts right now? We just got Aetna on board last week. We have AmeriHealth Caritas. We have Blue Cross. We have two additional states likely for 2025. So it's exciting to have this growth and interest. And I think one of the skepticisms we faced initially was not just from the funders, but from the health plans who said, oh, sure, I've had 100 people come pitch to me about how they can save me money and improve outcomes. Well, guess what? Last month, we got our first year data back and we saved double our ROI. And we were also able to significantly improve quality and reduce emergency room use by 60%. So those are the kind of things that really help you grow your business. But the business model itself is based on that family structure. We call it the magnifier effect. So the family kind of magnifies the number of people we can care for. When we drive and enter a home, we're dealing with multiple family members, not just one person. So that multiplier effect is really powerful.
How would you, though, handle a family where maybe it was just one kid or one parent?
Yeah, so we get assigned populations, and typically we get paid a per member per month across the cohort that's assigned to us, and then we go at risk for some of that, both on quality and cost. So we do not take single family homes, in part because we can't afford to do it, right? Unless it's a pregnant mom who's going to be two people or three people in my case, with my twins. When we go to the home, we really need to be able to see two people, but also it's about the outcomes improvement. I think we've just recently done the study on our ER reduction, and we compared it to City Block's first year and Waymark's first year. City Block had a 15% reduction in ER and Waymark 23, and we were able to reduce it by 60. Why so much better? I really think it's the family. It's if we are able to engage a mother and a caregiver and help her with resources on, A, here's how you can be healthy. Here's how we reduce your anxiety and trauma. Here's something you can do instead of going to an ER. We're here for you. All of a sudden, that's changed that entire family's behavior, not just her behavior, but what happens to all of her children. And we often find about 15% of the time that we've prevented one ED visit, we've prevented multiple. We cannot deal with children's well-being if the parents aren't well. And vice versa, there's a lot of data on if I'm a mom of a very sick child who has a mental health issue or a physical health issue, and that child is unmanaged, my stress is likely to be high. It's just obvious, but the whole family approach helps us magnify our outcomes as well as our reach and have better economics for what we're doing.
I wonder if there's a story of a particular family or client that really has impacted you. And what was the situation and how were you able to help them?
So a few months ago, I went into a home. I love to do home visits with a team. And this was a home where a grandma was taking care of a five-year-old boy. And his mother had been killed by gun violence. And he had seen it. First of all, this was a joyful, wonderful five-year-old boy who had some behavior problems for obvious reasons, right? There's trauma in that home. There was a life-size blow-up cardboard cutout of his mom in their living room. So it's kind of this constant reminder of her. And he talked to me about he wanted to bring it to his school to be with him. So, I mean, these are the kind of images, right? As a physician, I can find out a little bit about my patients in a 15-minute office visit, but I don't have these visuals and experiences. And then I think what really was powerful, and which is so upsetting that it's happening so frequently in America, is that he was so excited to have me there. He had no toys, right? We brought crayons. He had no toys. Grandma couldn't afford toys. There were no books in the home. And he wanted to get me a snack. He was so happy to have me there. And so I said, well, let's go to the kitchen. And we look in there, and the only thing they have to eat is two Rice Krispie treats because grandma's afraid to leave. So the point is, I think with just that one visit, we were able to deal with that family's trauma, get mental health for grandma and him, deal with, let's get this cardboard cutout, frankly, out of this living room, probably not the best. Let's get you food. How about let's get you involved in the food stamps program? So all of that we were able to do in an hour and a half visit, which is just was so impactful. And it's actually amazing the resilience of women and caregivers, right? It doesn't take very much to change the life of somebody, right? If you just having someone, and this is where the data out of Nurse Family Partnership is so powerful, the data around the intervention of just going to a home and saying, I am here and I'm here to care for you. Like, forget the medical piece of it. That is powerful. And so it's when you're in a home with Nest and you sit on the floor with the children, right? It's a much different experience than being in an aseptic doctor's office and the kids are crawling on you and they trust you and they're not crying when they get a vaccine because they're in their comfort environment. It just is it's wonderful to see. It's even better than I thought it would be when I thought of the idea.
And I remember the term, I think it was used by Paul Farmer, about accompaniment. And how if we can create systems of trust and accompany people in their journey, even when that journey is very hard and challenging, that is what's nourishing to the body and the soul, you know, that kind of support. One of the other results you had was around vaccination this last year.
Yeah.
And it was such a dramatic increase. So maybe use that as another way to talk about the impact that you had. And what do you think drove that dramatic increase in vaccination?
So we were able to, I talked about ER reduction, the 60%, our savings, but also what we're doing, and I don't think I mentioned this before, is one of the ways we get families is we go to the health plan and say, give us all of the children and moms who did not get primary care last year, right? And we looked at a couple other things, but what is in common with all the Nest families is they don't have a medical home. They're not going somewhere else. We're not taking them away from an existing relationship that they have. And what we've found is, a couple of things. One is that the home is an environment where you can more quickly build trust, right? And so part of that's vaccination, right? A big reason why people are not getting vaccinated is because they lost trust in government around COVID. Part of it is that we look like our community. So our team is mostly African American. Why? Because New Orleans is mostly African American. And so when we go into a home, we look like the community, we're sharing experiences with the community. That is an important trust builder. We also, again, are sitting on the ground with that child, with that mom. We come to the home armed with all the vaccines they'd need. And so one of the things is we've shown doubling of the primary care visits, because again, this is a population that did not have any. And then we've been able to double vaccinations against state baseline. So we've provided over 800 vaccinations in homes to our family. So really great uptake, I think, partly because of that trust, partly because of convenience. Another thing in Medicaid that I didn't know is when you're on Medicaid, you can't just go to CVS or Walgreens and get a vaccine for your child because those pharmacies don't participate in the Vaccines for Kids program. So it's a much higher bar. So just imagine you're a mom of five kids. That means five pediatrician appointments just to get your kids vaccinated. So again, I think to your point, accompaniment. When we accompany you, when we hear you, when we spend an hour and a half with you, and then we're there to answer your questions, it's a much more effective way of building trust than the current medical paradigm.
I want to take a step sideways to your time as Secretary of Health. You helped guide the state to its Medicaid expansion, which was historic in Louisiana. Take us back in time. How did you guide that process and what was the impact of that expansion on the health of Louisianans?
It was one of the greatest moments of my life was when the governor, I attended the signing of his first executive order and he tasked me to expand Medicaid. It was over 600,000 people that got coverage. And of course, as a practicing physician and as someone who had been CMO of Medicaid, I had seen what denial of care looks like, right? Women showing up with brain tumors that aren't treatable, cancers that aren't treatable, pregnancies that were preventable. I mean, just the inhumanity of it, right? Of preventing access and denying access to hundreds of thousands of our citizens to healthcare. So to be a part of changing that was amazing. And of course, overnight, the state had access to care. And part of that looked like building it into the budget, right? The governor built it into the budget where it saved hundreds of millions of dollars. So it was difficult for the legislators. We also, though, I spent a lot of my first year as secretary traveling the state, showing legislators their districts, how many people were working, who would get expansion, how many people were women, what this would do for the economy. So it was very much a process. But at the end of it, we had very widespread support, I think culminating in now, of course, a Republican governor who has maintained it and supports it. So that's positive. I do think certainly the health benefits are increased access to preventive care, increased access to specialty care, and all the things that go along with having healthcare.
I was really struck in my conversation with Cody Kinsley in the last year about sort of the same story, which is the journey across the state to garner support and talk to people about the impact of Medicaid, and how the people that came together were as driven by the economic benefit, employers coming forward, sheriffs coming forward and saying, we need this for our local jurisdictions. This is going to help us. We're at another point in time where there's going to be, I hope, strong arguments to support and maintain Medicaid. We know that it's in the crosshairs for the Trump administration and the legislature. I'm curious, as someone who's navigated that bringing together of voices and garnering of support for Medicaid, what are the opportunities to do that again today? And what would a strategy to do that look like?
So it's interesting. So I had an opportunity 2 weeks ago. So Nest came out with our savings numbers. We put out some really good information about the health of children and the opportunities. And Elon Musk retweeted it. So, you know, as a result of that, we actually got a lot of press. But I wrote back to him and said, I'm glad you like this concept. And just remember, don't cut healthcare for children, because we'll be paying far more for that than you will ever save. Right. So I think it's those kind of messages. It's looking at where do we have commonality. Someone who's a dear friend of mine is Bill Cassidy. Right. He and I don't always agree, but we find commonality, right? We're looking at a hepatitis C initiative right now that would save $6.5 billion that comes from some of the work we did when I was secretary. So the best defense is a good offense. So having that story, having the impact, being able to explain it, being bipartisan about it, bringing people in, and those are all tactics that I have utilized. And certainly Nest is something that is supported by folks across both aisles. It is not a political company. We're here to take care of children and parents.
Ultimately, you left the administration in Louisiana at a time when there was a lawsuit and ended up leaving to align with your values. What was happening at that time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my name was on a Supreme Court case. It was June Medical v. Gee. And that could have been the Dobbs case, right? It was a admitting privileges case that if the Supreme Court had decided in Louisiana's favor, and again, why was my name on it? My name was on it because I was the titular head of the health department. So I embodied the health department. There was no way of getting my name off of it. There was no, it wasn't my choice. It was just the way that it had to be. And so I made a decision. It was going to the Supreme Court in March, and I had to make a decision whether I was willing to have my name on that. And that was not something that aligned with my values. We all have to make those choices, you know, in government jobs, especially if we're not elected officials. We work for those who are elected and at their pleasure. And ultimately, back to kind of my mom's career and ethics, we have to decide what is it that we're willing to sacrifice. And, you know, I was willing to support my governor, even though he was pro-life and I didn't agree with that, because we expanded coverage for over 400,000 women and did this great work. But then there's a time when, you know, it just doesn't align So, but I was still admire my former governor and all of the people I worked with and just had such a phenomenal experience in that role.
I want to take us back to that moment when you were talking to the venture capitalist who ended up backing you and you had all these ideas. And I think many people are concerned about our new Secretary of Health's approach to vaccination, but are intrigued at the idea of making America healthy again, especially if that means focusing on systemic changes in food systems and things like that. If you were to design a strategy to make America healthy again, what would that look like?
Well, part it's nuts, right? Health looks like nutrition in the home, healthy people mentally. It looks like thriving families and thriving communities. And that's the work we're about at Nest. I think, you know, the fact that we're very much aligned that nutrition is important to health and that we have been, you know, in some ways that the poor foods we've been feeding our children, especially low-income children, are kind of the next tobacco issue is we're poisoning our kids, right? We're feeding them dyes and sugars that are making them sick. And so, yeah, I align with that. We should be thinking about healthy foods. We should be thinking about mental well-being. We have had a sick care system for a very long time, and we are one of the unhealthiest countries in the developed world. So I do think a fresh approach to this is helpful, but what I hope will not happen, and certainly is, we know vaccines have saved more lives than any single intervention in human history. So let's not tamper with that. We just had some measles cases in Texas. That's extremely concerning. You know, we know that healthcare, in my view, is a human right. Let's not take healthcare away from people and have them suffering needlessly of ailments that are preventable in a country that is wealthy and can afford it. That's unacceptable from a human rights standpoint. And it also will not save us money because we've tried that and it has not worked. So I think where I align with this administration is, you know, primary care is a priority. Let's prevent illness. Let's stop focusing on things that don't work. Let's look at creative approaches for partnership. So I do hope that these approaches can make some more prioritization possible for Nest. Because one thing I'll say that's frustrating as the CEO of a company focused on children and mothers is we've really neglected them, right? We don't invest in our children to the level we should. We spend so much on end of life and seniors, and we don't invest in children's nutrition in the way we should and in their education and the prevention of illness. And that is so important. So I'd love to see, and also when we're so focused on savings in 1 year. If I'm dealing with a baby that gets no care, I'm not going to save money if I care for that baby in that year. I will save money over years. So I'm also interested in what are those approaches to look at longer term gains for society, which are more, you know, focused on the health function rather than the sick function.
All of these stories have demonstrated just extremely thoughtful, ethical leadership. Your mom would be incredibly proud of you. And that involves bravery and courage. And I think a lot of people are asking themselves right now, what does it look like for me in whatever position I'm in to be a courageous leader? I'm curious what advice you would give them or what experience you've had in your life that guides your brave leadership.
I laugh because I literally got hit by an SUV and lived. My first husband was killed. So I always say it's easier to be brave when you've had a near-death experience because nothing can be worse than that. Yeah. So I do think the thing that I try to remember, and part of this does come from having had that near-death experience. So I spent 3 months in a wheelchair. I was very lucky to live. Is that you should wake up every day saying, this is a new day. What can I contribute today? How do I have perspective today and create a meaningful life? And so, you know, I was talking this morning, I thought that the lawyers in New York were so brave to say, look, I was asked to keep this mayor afloat and I don't believe in this and I'm going to quit. And these were people across the political spectrum. So I have a lot of faith in people's humanity and in their moral compass. It's just we're going to have to continue to use it and speak out. And I know our colleagues in public health today are very frightened. I mean, I'm frightened. I've just had several colleagues fired who I think very highly of. And, you know, we don't just grow scientists on trees. These are not people that will just come back. You know, America's greatness has been in part defined by our innovations in science. I remember John Glenn was a mentor of mine, who, of course, was an astronaut. And
this is why you wanted to be an astronaut, right?
In part, yeah, yeah. I mean, he then dissuaded me because, you know, he had to basically strap himself onto a bomb to do that. But, you know, it's about America's greatness is about our spirit of innovation, our magnanimity, our, you know, the joyfulness and creativity that we have as a people. We've got to fight for that. Public health is important. Wherever we can, let's do the right thing.
It's been such a pleasure to talk with you. I just love the weaving of the story of your life and how you've brought it to this moment with this incredible company. I wish I would have had those services for my family and my kids when they were growing up. Thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you. It was great to talk with you.
In her very final days, Rebecca's mom wrote letters to her daughter, hoping to guide her through life. And you can feel that legacy living on in Rebecca, a woman who faced her own brush with death and came through it with the confidence to ask the hard questions and start a company, even when people around her doubted it could succeed. It highlights for me the importance of passing down what we've learned to the generations after us. And so, here's what I want to pass down, specifically to the new generation of public health leaders who are about to graduate. While the job market may seem bleak, I want you to know that your ideas, your passion for change, your vision for the future is what we desperately need right now. So don't bury your good idea. Don't downplay your passion. Don't think for one second that the future doesn't need the fresh, new energy you bring to our work. Take a risk and try something new, even when everyone is telling you it's not going to work. This podcast was created by me, Claudia Williams. My podcast producer is Avery Moore Kloss. Check out the show notes for more information on Rebecca Gee and her company, Nest. There is more information on my background, this podcast, and our guests on our website, www.theother80.com. Until next time, I'm Claudia Williams.